Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, regular listeners, you may have spotted that we've changed our name. It's now Honey & Co. The Food Sessions.
So if you hear this sound, it's just us making dinner.
Well, that and the fact that we're not allowed to use our old title anymore.
It's just been a bit of a thing, but don't worry about it.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, I'm Sarit Thacker.
I'm Itamar Srulovic. Together we run a couple of Middle Eastern restaurants in London.
And we also do our fair share of food writing.
And welcome to Series 6 of Honey & Co.
It's a series of talks we host in our little deli, Honey & Spice, on Warren Street. We talk to chefs and cookbook writers and waiters and managers and people we admire from the world of food.
This season we got to meet some incredible people. We've cooked their food. We've learned so much. We are so excited to share this with you. I hope you enjoy as much as we did. Today we are joined by a true food hero of ours, Tim Anderson. Tim's an American who fell in love with Japanese food and cooking and devoted his life to it. It's his obsession, profession, and passion. Tim wrote the book Tokyo Stories. It's a book as exuberant, as vibrant as the city is. We had a magnificent evening talking about cocktails in a can from vending machines. We talked about sandwiches from convenience stores, and it was great fun.
I have to say that I first saw this guy, Tim, on MasterChef. That was the only season of MasterChef I've ever watched. I think that was 2010 or 11, something like that.
2011, yeah. It was the first year it was on BBC One.
Yeah, yeah. I was not working that year.
Neither was I.
Yeah, obviously. But this is the only season that I've ever watched, and I was rooting for you so much.
Thank you.
I have a soft spot for the food of Japan. Actually, I like your food. Mm. Please help me give a big hand to this guy, Tim Anderson.
Thank you.
Always meet your heroes. We are going to talk about Tim's new book, Tokyo Story, sorry. Tim.
Yeah.
From Wisconsin to Tokyo.
Yeah.
How?
Well,
how did this happen?
I've always been a nerd. My whole life I've been a nerd, and when I was a kid,
you're amongst friends here.
Yeah,
this is where all the food nerds.
Nerd power, yeah, nerd pride in this room. I can feel it. So I was particularly a nerd about sort of Japanese pop culture when I was a kid. When I was a teenager, I was into video games and J-pop and a little bit of anime and manga, but not really that much. But also I was into cooking, and like when I'd come home from school in the afternoon, I'd switch on the TV and it was always Food Network. And I'd watch like Emeril Lagasse and Martin Yan and Anthony Bourdain was first starting off back then. So like I just watch Food Network all night. And there was a show that came on the Food Network in America called Iron Chef, which has gone on to be remade in America and in the UK. It was short-lived, but they did it here. It was a cooking competition show from Japan that just blew my mind. Like, I'd never seen anything like it. It was a really over-the-top show, like, just in terms of the style in which it was presented. Like,
high drama.
High drama. Yeah. It takes place at a place called Kitchen Stadium. And and the host was this guy named Chairman Kaga, who was a theater actor in Japan. And he dressed like Liberace. Like, he was a Japanese Liberace. And they had these Iron Chefs who were supposed to be the very top chefs in their category in Japan. French, Chinese, Japanese, and Italian. And they'd have challengers from all over the world who were equally as good, and they have secret ingredients that started off each battle, they called them. And I, some of the ingredients were just mind-blowing to me, things I'd never seen before growing up in Wisconsin. And then the food was incredible. Not just the Japanese food, but that level of cooking in general. And it was dubbed over like an old kung fu movie. Like, because they had like play-by-play commentary. It was like a sporting match.
Yeah.
So I watched this show, and like I feel like they wouldn't show this show now the way TV is. Like, it wouldn't have been put on the air because it's too weird. But back then, they were just like, ah, we got a 10 o'clock at night slot, whatever. We'll get this crazy show from Japan
on.
You
say that about so many things.
It's true. Like, yeah.
All of the 90s, you can say that about.
Yeah, but even like A Cook's Tour, Anthony Bourdain's first show, when that came on, it was on at like 11 o'clock at night. Because like, it was like too crazy. Because they had a meeting Cobra Hearts in Vietnam and stuff like that. But anyway, this show just blew my mind, and I was like, wow. And I was already interested in Japanese pop culture and stuff. So I was like, I want to learn more about Japanese food. I'd never seen anything like it. So I went to the very few Japanese restaurants that we had in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee. I'd drive up there and eat sushi and yakitori and udon and basic stuff when I was in high school.
And they'd be like, oh, that's that weird kid again.
Yeah. He's here again.
Yeah.
Ordering the fried rice. Because that was like my favorite kind of, that was my favorite thing. Like sushi, I would try it. Like there was a lot of Japanese food I didn't like because it was weird to me. Like when I first had sushi, it wasn't the raw fish that was weird. It was the seaweed. We have nothing like that flavor or texture in Wisconsin, in like traditional Wisconsin cuisine. We have things a bit like raw fish, like we have smoked salmon and stuff like that. So that kind of thing wasn't that weird.
Easier to relate to.
Yeah, but like I remember having to acquire the taste for nori seaweed for sure.
I don't know if you ever listened to the Kitchen Cabinet where Tim is on, but it's the very famous Mama Anderson cookbook. Mm. No seaweed
yes.
there.
No seaweed.
No seaweed.
Although, weirdly, there's some bizarre kind of Japanese connections going back in my family history. Like, my grandparents had a Japanese exchange student in the 70s, I think, 60s or 70s. So there's actually,
okay,
like,
that's a
leafing through
connection.
My family recipe books. Yeah, well, there's recipes for tempura and, like, a green tea cocktail in my family recipe box from the 70s. It's, like, kind of crazy. And there's a Kikkoman soy sauce factory in Wisconsin because we grow, seriously, because we grow really good soybeans and wheat. So they put a factory there. And so we always had Kikkoman soy sauce in the house. But anyway, it was quite weird to me starting off Japanese food. But then I loved a lot of it. And I knew there was something kind of interesting about it. And I moved to LA to go to college there. And that was a conscious decision because I knew that there would be more Japanese culture and more Japanese food that I could sink my teeth into there. And that's where I discovered like ramen or konomiyaki and yakitori properly and like Japanese soul food stuff. That's what I really came to love. And I studied Japanese food history and food culture. And I got to go to Japan on a research grant in 2005.
So you basically got a grant to eat noodles.
Basically. No, seriously. Well, it started off as exactly that. It started off as a research project on regional noodles in Japan. But what it became was about local food museums. There's a lot of, you travel from place to place and there's always different local specialties, and a lot of them, they have actual museums set up to celebrate them. So like in Yokohama, there's this amazing ramen museum. Yeah, I went to a mountain town in Nagano Prefecture that has a soba museum. There's a salmon museum up in Hokkaido. There's beer museums and sake museums all over the place. The weirdest one was a salt and tobacco museum, which is not quite a food museum, I guess.
Yeah, well, half.
Yeah, but that's because the salt, well, it doesn't matter. They're weirdly linked by this one big corporation in Japan. But anyway, the more I learned about Japanese food and food culture, the more interesting it became because I realized that there's always something new and unexpected to try and to learn about. And I lived in Fukuoka Prefecture in the south of Japan in Kyushu. And Kyushu was historically like where all the foreigners came into Japan.
Yeah.
Because it's the closest to mainland Asia and it's closest to the Spice Islands. So like Portuguese, Dutch, and British traders would come up through there. The Koreans and the Chinese would come over into Nagasaki or Fukuoka as well. Then you started getting the American military in there at the end of the 19th century. So Kyushu is where you get this real kind of, I don't want to call it a melting pot, but it's a real mix of things that you don't really expect from Japanese food. And actually, the more you learn about regional places, regional specialties throughout Japan, the more you see that kind of like blending into other cultures all over the place, actually.
But you were kind of on a very scholarly trajectory. You never...
Yes.
Or were you... I mean, it sounds like it. It wasn't like, oh, yeah, I'm going to be a, you know, Iron Chef.
Right. No, I think about this a lot. I probably should have been a historian, not a chef. because I'm better at reading and writing than I am at cooking.
Well, you know, I can argue that point.
But. Yeah, but no, that's what really fascinates me is these really kind of obscure, unusual things about Japanese cooking. I love like the mainstream Japanese cuisine as well, but what's exciting to me whenever I go to Japan and when I lived there was being able to go to a new place or even just staying in one city and finding these new things that have this amazing, interesting history usually as well behind them.
So how did you cross the line from food research or food historian or historian to actually saying, hey,
cooking.
Yeah.
It was
not a natural leap. You know,
no, it was always a hobby. Yeah. And one of the first things I ever learned to cook was fried rice because it's easy. Anybody can cook fried rice. You cook rice and then or you have leftover rice from a takeaway or whatever. And then it'll kind of take anything. You just learn how to stir fry something and how to season it. Yeah, and you go from there. But it was a hobby. And living in Japan was amazing because I made a point whenever I went and did my shop at the supermarket every week to try something that I didn't know what it was. Because if you live in... Well, you could do the same thing in London, probably. Like, London supermarkets are really interesting because depending on where you live, they'll have stuff from that represents the local community. So, like, in South London, in Lewisham, where I live, you can get, like, saltfish and ackee in our local Sainsbury's.
Yeah.
So, like, in Japan, I would go to the shop and, like, instead of just buying, like, the normal stuff that I knew how to cook or knew what it was, I'd buy stuff that I deliberately was like, I don't know what this is. I'm going to take it home and figure it out, you know? Yeah. And that was great for my language skills as well, because then I'd have to learn new words. I'd have to look up recipes in Japanese. So, yeah, that's how it started. Just like, you know, I grew up watching cooking shows. Like I said, I always loved food. And so cooking it as a hobby was natural. And I didn't think about doing it professionally, really, until I moved here and I saw MasterChef. And I was like, oh, that looks... That's a fun
vaguely
thing
familiar,
to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, it all started.
And I just kind of, to be honest, it sounds funny, but I kind of fell into it because I just applied online. It takes like 20 minutes. I didn't think anything of it. Seriously. And I never thought I'd win. Never. From day one, I thought I'm not the best cook in the room, which is what that show is all about. But I thought I could maybe be the weirdest.
Yeah.
which would maybe keep me in the game for a while.
Yeah. I think this kind of strategy worked for our current prime minister, so why not?
It's not a bad strategy. Just be the guy who they're like, well, that guy's
what
doing
is he
something.
Doing?
Yeah. And then, you know, then at the end, to be honest, like we'd all, for most of MasterChef, it's elimination. So you don't have to be the best, you just have to not be the worst. And it's not until the very end when you do have to be the best. And I guess I just barely clinched it in the end.
Because, I mean, after that, there was Nanban, your restaurant.
So when I moved here from Japan, there wasn't the kind of Japanese food that I loved, specifically ramen. We had, you know, Wagamama, and we had some okay little places, like family-run places. But we didn't have the really like rich pork broth tonkotsu ramen that I loved and I fell in love with first in LA and then in Japan. So I always wanted to open a ramen shop, but then a lot of other people did that as well before I did. So like Bone Daddy's Tonkotsu, they opened in 2011, something like that. And then I thought, okay, well, that's been done, but also there's still all this regional food that I think is really interesting. Yeah. So let's do a whole like kind of Kyushu, Southern Japan concept, and that's what Nanban is.
Because it is a very, like, your brand or your type of Japanese, let's say, cooking and offering, actually, in this book and in the previous one. There's something very particular about it. It's kind of soul food, maybe? Is that...
Yeah, I chose... So, like, my first book, Nanban, is the subtitle Japanese Soul Food, and that's what we use at the restaurant as well.
Yeah.
And I can't take credit for that. That I stole from Ippudo, the ramen chain. They opened in New York... in Manhattan years ago, and that was their slogan when they opened. I thought that's really clever because soul food in America, first of all, comes from the South.
Yeah.
It comes from the South of the United States, and also it's got its roots in like immigrant communities. So like ramen is a great example because it comes from the South of Japan, and it's originally a Chinese dish. Like it was originally made by Chinese expats in Japan. But also not just ramen. There's all these other things that come from immigrant communities within Japan that I thought was really interesting, and that's why I use the soul food label. But also, it's kind of expanded now to be just anything that's kind of like hearty and probably unhealthy, usually like a lot of salt, sugar, fat, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is the kind of Japanese food, to be fair, that I really love. And it also goes with like izakaya style dining, like really casual stuff, and a lot of home cooking. That's just like hearty, puts a smile on your face, conducive to drinking beer or sake. Like, yeah.
Which is, you know, convivial and fun and easy.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can maybe think about Japanese food as very intimidating.
Yeah.
And, you know, you need to learn 17 years how to cook a pot of rice and things like that.
And don't get me wrong, it is that also.
Yeah.
If you want to make sushi and make it well, it's very hard. Like, you can make sushi at home, no problem. Like, you follow the steps and it's a perfectly doable thing. But if you want to make really good sushi or anything, ramen, for example, it takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of practice and it takes a lot of learning.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's another side to Japanese food as well.
Yeah, but I think this is kind of what we do love about Japanese food and Japanese culture, is that kind of specification. And
yeah.
You know, the expertise and, you know, the seeking out for good ingredients and things like that.
Well, that's another good point, is like, you know, I make ramen and I make pretty good ramen. I don't make the best ramen, but like, you couldn't put me in a sushi restaurant. Like, I couldn't do it. Like, I can make decent enough sushi, but if you put me in a sushi restaurant in Japan, they would throw me out in about 5 minutes. Angrily, like, I can make ramen, but it's a specialist thing. Like, most restaurants, if you can even call them that in Japan, most places you go to eat, they'll specialize in one thing. Like, they'll do yakitori and that's it, or they'll do sushi and that's it. And likewise, you couldn't take a great sushi chef and say, make a bowl of ramen. It's a very different thing. And like, we're used to, in this country, I think, and in America and most places, being able to go to a restaurant and ordering like anything you want, which is not, I think, how you make the best product. And I think that they understand that in Japan. They specialize.
This book, we've been to Tokyo, me and my wife, 12 years ago, and it's just such an amazing place.
Yeah.
And this book is, you know, for those of you who have been, this is, you know, you just want to go again. And those of you who haven't been, you'll be aching to go. Really, you'll be aching to go. Because it just, I feel, just transfers so much of what is fun and amazing and incredible about this city.
Thank you.
And it is so overwhelming. And it's like, now I'm trying to think, how did we even get from one place to another? Because there's nothing's in English. Nobody.
No, not really.
But somehow it works.
Well, part of it is that people are really helpful.
So nice.
Yeah. I remember I don't remember if it was my first trip to Tokyo or my second, but I didn't speak Japanese at that point. I still barely speak Japanese. But I was standing looking at a map of the subway system in Tokyo, just clearly, totally confused. And an old lady came up and like...
There's always an old lady.
Always an old lady.
There's always an old lady.
It was like, where are you trying to go? And she, I was like, I'm trying to get here. And she took me over to the machine and she like helped me buy the ticket and everything. And that wasn't the only time that happened to me.
There's always an old lady. They take you everywhere. I think they kind of... they're kind of the tourist board.
Like, yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Anyway, this is, you know, it's such an incredible city. There's so much, you know, going everywhere you look. It's such an assault on the senses. Mm. And, you know, even in the first page of the book, I'll paraphrase, says, you know, it talks a little bit about Paris syndrome. Do you hear about Paris syndrome? That people go to Paris and then they're really disappointed and they get depressed.
Yeah, and anxious.
Because it's all kind of, you know, McDonald's, basically.
Yeah.
And then, but you, in Tokyo, however hyped up about going there and however, you know, high your expectations are, you're always never prepared.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you're always underprepared. It's incredible. It's such an assault.
I mean, I went to Tokyo for the first time. I was either 17 or 18, and you couldn't have been more excited than me. I was so excited to go to Tokyo, but it was so overwhelming because I'd been to Chicago and maybe LA at that point, but those cities are just nothing compared to Tokyo. It's so big and so dense. I was just watching Wild Japan, this BBC nature documentary about Japan. They mentioned how Tokyo is 35 million people. That's half of the UK in one little... I mean, it's not a little city, but it's not that much bigger than London. Like, it's insanely dense. And so you get there and just... Most people will stay in Shinjuku, which is like one of the biggest entertainment districts and business districts. And walking around Shinjuku for the first time, like, you just... You're looking everywhere, up and down and all over, because there's neon and signs and lights, and like, you don't, most of you probably wouldn't understand the language. I didn't at that point, and it's just like everything, it's kind of dizzying. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But it's great.
It's so exhilarating.
Yeah.
It's so exhilarating. And I mean, you do want someone, you know, be it an old lady or whatever, but you want someone to kind of take you by the hand and show you behind the scene. And I think, you know, I would love to go to Tokyo with you.
Well, let's go.
Let's go.
That'd be awesome.
But I think this book is kind of the alternative, because it has so much insight into the town and into its food and its, you know, kind of little nooks and crannies. It's full of, you know, recommendations.
Yeah.
But this is what I wanted you to read. Well, I had so much fun with this book, actually.
Okay. So this is actually really accurate. So this is what I call a typical day on a trip to Tokyo. Start the day on a toilet more sophisticated than your car. Snarf some stringy, sticky, smelly fermented soybeans for breakfast. Get lost in the labyrinthine obstacle course of Shinjuku Station. Have a peaceful stroll around the Imperial Palace Gardens. Get lunch at a robot, maid, butler, cat, owl, or Hello Kitty cafe. Lose an hour and several thousand yen at one of Akihabara's multi-story arcades. Ogle the tourists and touristy tat along Nakamise Dori. Purchase some surprisingly beautiful hand-carved chopsticks and a bottle of fizzy ramune. Kick off the evening with an all-you-can-drink lager deal. Head to an izakaya and eat all the food. Drink shochu, make friends, do karaoke, accidentally walk into a brothel, walk back out, quickly. A little more shochu, ham sandwich from the konbini. Hello again, fancy toilet. Bedtime. So one thing that's in there that's interesting to me is the stroll through a palace garden, because one thing I learned writing this book and going there to photograph it and researching it was that actually I've never lived in Tokyo, and so I only have an experience of going there as like a tourist or sometimes for work. But when you live there, you do find these pockets of like serenity, which was... Like, I never, like, knew about that in Tokyo. I just thought it's all unbroken, crazy city as far as you can go. But we went to little local temples. We went to neighborhoods looking for certain local foods that are just neighborhoods, like, that have little old ladies pushing shopping carts and kids going to school and peaceful gardens and stuff like that. So this is another thing. Like, even if you just go to Tokyo, there's so much to explore. You keep finding new sides to it. I've been to Tokyo 8 or 9 times, and you'd think I'd be kind of, like, done with it by now. But this is, like, what I'm saying. There's always something new.
Also wrote the book.
Right, yeah. There's always something new to find and always a new angle to view Tokyo in.
I just want to talk about the itinerary because I think traditionally the first day in Tokyo, you kind of ride the jet lag and go to the fish market.
Ah,
this
yes.
This is what you do.
Yeah, although
but
that
you don't
fish,
do that anymore.
Well, no, the fish market, Tsukiji, the famous fish market, is now closed and has been relocated to Toyosu. And it was always a bit kind of dicey going there because you had to kind of sneak in. They didn't really want tourists there. Yeah. And when we went this last time, which is one of the last opportunities we had to shoot there before it's closed forever, they were very, very strict. They wouldn't let us in until after trading hours, which is totally understandable. But the new market, I think it's kind of a shame. You'll never recapture the how Tsukiji was. It was a very, like, rough and ready, gritty kind of dirty fish market,
well,
actually.
For Japan.
Yeah.
Which means immaculately clean in every conceivable way.
But it was amazing. I remember the first time I went there, which was years ago, just the sights and the sounds and the smells of all the seafood being prepared and all kinds of seafood. And so fresh.
Yeah.
So fresh. I remember seeing they had prawns that they'd package up in these little nice wooden boxes with plastic wrap over them, still kicking inside that plastic wrap. And sea urchins that people were carving out and taking the eggs out of and then lining them up neatly in packages. And tuna the size of, like, me that people were putting on band saws and cutting off their heads. And these knives that were, like, actual swords that they had to use to cut these tuna down. And then buckets of guts everywhere. It was just, like, there was a carnage to it. But there was also an order, like, and you could see sort of, like, order being... order coming out of chaos, yeah. Basically. It was amazing. And then you get to go to a sushi place right around the corner for breakfast and have some of the freshest fish you'll ever have for your sushi breakfast. But now they've got, like, I don't know, I haven't been to the new market. They've got special viewing platforms for tourists and restaurant arcades and stuff all set up so that you don't interfere with the people who are actually working in the market, which is an issue.
Yeah, I think it'll be quite just as soulful and interesting in about 100-150 years.
Yeah.
Something like that. Once, just need to give it some time.
Once it's run down.
Yeah, once it's just let it, you know, tumble a little bit. But there is so much in terms of, you know, the food in Tokyo.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much, but just the food, there is so much going on. Like, how did you even start breaking it down? Like, how... Tell us about the kind of structure of the book.
It's hard because Tokyo is so... There's so much there. And it's hard to condense down into, I don't know, 80 recipes or however many we have in here, especially when I was trying to give some background information on each one. But I wanted to basically provide a good, thorough snapshot of Tokyo at every level because there are many, many levels, and that's how I structured the book. So the first chapter is based on Depachika, which are department store basements, which is how I introduce ingredients because department store food halls in Japan are a great way to see, well, first of all, sort of the legendary Japanese produce, like the expensive fruit and fantastic quality seafood and stuff like that, but also all the international food that people in Tokyo and in other parts of Japan are eating. So you'll always find great French pastries in the department store food halls and things like that, and great wine and cheese and spices because it's a very cosmopolitan city. So that's the first chapter. Then we move up to what we call lower ground floor, and that's convenience stores and vending machines, which are excellent in Japan. Usually you go to a country, any country, and convenience stores are the last place you'd find good food. But in Japan, they have amazing distribution models and logistics so that the food is always good. It's always fresh. They really have their, like, systems worked out. Everything is well stocked.
When we were there, I think we kind of just passed it by. And now I'm gutted that we've...
No, you gotta go into those convenience stores and just... Even if you're just looking for, like, interesting flavors of crisps, which are great. Like, you can get, like, wasabi beef and ones flavored, like, different kinds of ramen and stuff like that. And cocktails in a can, which are really nice. But also, like, the fried chicken is surprisingly good from a convenience store because they fry it there. They fry it on premises. They're not just, like, getting it frozen and heating it up. They have little fryers, and they have this stuff called oden, which is like a dashi-based stew that they have set in this vat of dashi, and you pick out the ingredients you want from it on skewers, and you pay by the skewer. They hand it to you in a big plastic bucket. and they top it up with hot dashi and hot mustard. It's just the best thing on like a cold, rainy day to stick your nose into the billowing dashi vapor. So like convenience stores, you're not going to get the best food in Japan, but you'll kind of be missing out if you don't eat at a convenience store at least once. The sandwiches, the rice balls, even the noodles and the salads are great. A lot of love for konbini. Then we move up to the first floor, which I focus on local specialties in Tokyo. And some of those are just like Tokyo-specific versions of national dishes, like different kinds of ramen or gyoza or sushi, which originated in Tokyo. Or you get really unusual, super local things like monjayaki, which is like it's a batter filled with vegetables and like a lot of chopped cabbage and sauce that you cook on a griddle in front of you, but it never really solidifies. So it's like eating melted cheese. You scrape it off the griddle in front of you, and it's weird, but it's delicious. And you get these kind of fisherman community specialties like Fukagawa rice, which is a clam rice dish because clams are really plentiful and cheap in Tokyo Bay. But they're super local. They're like a strictly East Tokyo thing. But that's some of the most interesting food to me in Tokyo because you can't really get it anywhere else. Then the next level is about regional Japanese food that you can get in Tokyo as well. Like I said before, like a lot of my favorite food in Japan is super regional. You have to go to a certain place to get it. But because so many people move to Tokyo from other parts of the country, they bring their food with them. One of the best examples is Ainu food. So the Ainu are an indigenous, like aborigine group in the north of Japan who have been assimilated into Japanese culture. And it's really, really rare to find their food anywhere, even in the north. But you can get Ainu food in Tokyo, and it's really, really interesting. They do things with like foraged wild herbs and cured salmon and venison, which is quite unusual in Japan. So from all over Japan, you can like get a nice tasting tour of the country just within Tokyo. Then we move up to international food, and some of that is just food from elsewhere, food from other countries that's just done really well in Tokyo, like pizza. There's great Neapolitan pizza in Japan now. But there's also like kind of dirty garbage pizza. Like they do like the Korean kind, barbecue pizza at Domino's in Japan, which is good for another reason. Or French pastries in the shape of Totoro, the anime character.
I love the linguine.
Oh, yeah. So there's a recipe linguine in here for sea urchin linguine, which is like super Japanese, but also like super Italian. Like you couldn't really place it in either country. Like it depends on who's making it, where it's being made. So there's a lot of great crossover stuff like that. And Korean barbecue, there's a huge Korean population in Tokyo, so you got to get Korean barbecue when you go to Japan or to Tokyo. Anyway, then then there's a Tokyo at Home chapter, which is all about the kind of food you can make in Tokyo in a tiny Tokyo kitchen, because apartments in Tokyo tend to be very, very small.
This I found really interesting, because this, I think most of us going will not have access to this type of cooking.
Well, I haven't had much. I've had a few friends in Tokyo who have been in their flats, and like it's literally you have a sink and like a two-ring electric burner and a rice cooker, and that's it. And it's like, well, what can you make with that? And it actually turns out,
what can't you make with it?
Well, yeah, you can make quite a lot, but they don't usually have ovens, so there's not a lot of that. But what you do have in Tokyo, even if you have a tiny kitchen, is access to some amazing ingredients. Even if it's not like the most expensive stuff, like even the basic grocery store stuff or convenience store stuff is really good.
Yeah.
Tokyo, like home cooking and Japanese home cooking in general is simple because it has to be, but also really, really delicious because the ingredients are so good. Anyway, then the last chapter is called Tokyo Modern. So it's about like modernist gastronomy and fine dining and also cocktails.
Cocktail or two, yeah.
Yeah, in Tokyo, including one that's inspired by a place called Gen Yamamoto, which does cocktail tasting menus, which sounds dangerous, but they're not very big. And he structures them like a traditional Japanese kaiseki meal. So they're all based on seasonal local produce from all over Japan made into cocktail form. So, like, you'll have a great tomato cocktail.
I want to show the picture because it's so mouthwateringly good.
So he'll feature on the menu, like, this is made from grapes from Yamanashi Prefecture, or this is made from milk from Hokkaido.
This, the umeboshi martini, that's so high up on my list.
It's that's a strong one, that one.
Feels potent.
But, like, this is the thing about Tokyo. It's, first of all, there's good food at every level. You don't have to spend a lot of money. You hardly have to spend any money.
Yeah, this is what I love, that you have kind of the super fancy, you know, top ingredient cocktail at the kind of higher end, but then you get a cocktail from the vending machine.
Absolutely.
And yeah, it's excellent.
It's really, really good. Dry shochu highball from the vending machine. People always say, oh, Tokyo is very expensive. It's a very expensive trip. And I always kind of get that impression too, because I always end up so poor after I go to Tokyo. But I realize it's not because everything is more expensive. It's just because everything is awesome and you want to buy everything.
You want one of each.
You're constantly just spending money because it's like, wow, look at that thing. I'm going to get that. And you're spending money all day long. Even if it's cheap stuff, it adds up.
Yeah. Just for the packaging, actually.
Yeah. Going back to the department store food halls, like going into like the sweets section of those food halls, they're just beautiful. Like, and they'll have a range of both traditional Japanese sweets, which are usually kind of like bean and jelly and chestnut-based. But then you move on from those to the French stuff, and they have these gorgeous Mont Blancs and Paris Brests and stuff like that, which are way better than most of the French pastries you get in France, by the way. And I love France, and I love French pastries, but it's just incredible. Like, I spend hours and hours in department store food halls every time I'm there, and loads of money. Always take an empty bag. Always take an empty suitcase to Japan so that you can fill it up with stuff to bring back.
I mean, this is why I thought this book is such a great guidebook, because on every recipe there's a reference to where's the best place to go for it.
Yeah, well, which is one of the best places. It's hard to pick the best, but yeah. It's funny, like, you've written cookbooks, and the thing you want when you write cookbooks is for people to cook the recipes and to enjoy them, right?
Yeah.
But with this one, I want that, obviously, but I also want people to go to Japan, to go to Tokyo and see it for themselves, because it's just, like, it's so fun. It's just so fun, and it doesn't matter if you're not interested in Japanese food or Japanese culture. You'll obviously get that and engage with that. But like I said, like, if you just want to go try some great pizza or French food or Chinese food, Tokyo's got it all. Like, it's a great city for anybody. Honestly, I really believe that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this book really, you know, for me, really took me there. Tell me about a few things that you've discovered writing this book that you didn't, that caught you by surprise.
So I always think of Tokyo as having no real local food. Like, a lot of capital cities are the same, because local food is so often tied to agriculture.
Yeah.
And also to local foods come up, I think, often because people feel like they need to invent them, because they need to feel proud of what they have around them. And if you're the capital city and you're a big important place, you don't need to do that, because you're like, we're the best already. It doesn't matter. You come and you eat what we have. So I never thought of Tokyo as having local food, because it doesn't really have agriculture. But what I neglected to think about or consider was that it's always had fishing. So there's a huge amount of interesting seafood dishes that I didn't know about in Japan. And also I learned more about sushi researching this, which I think it's interesting to trace its roots back a bit, because now we know it as raw fish on vinegared rice. And how that started was from the same tradition as fish sauce in Southeast Asia and salted preserved fish. So that came up by China, and the sort of primordial sushi is called funazushi. What it is you take rice, fish, a whole fish, and cooked rice and salt, and you pack them together. And then the salt starts to ferment the rice, and the lactic acid that comes from the fermentation preserves a fish, and you eat this kind of rotten fish rice thing.
And selling it.
Yeah. Well, it's not very popular anymore in Japan, but you still
wonder why.
You can't get it, yeah. But over time, they realize, oh, we can skip a step. We don't have to ferment this. We can just salt and vinegar the rice, and that'll help preserve the rice and the fish. And then they stop preserving it altogether and just started eating it fresh. And that's how we have sushi. So it's like this very uniquely Japanese thing, but it came from this much older, more distant tradition. And then you have something like tsukudani, which is a very, very economical recipe that I love. Tsukudani is preserved seaweed, sometimes like baby fish or shellfish, but more often seaweed. So, like, if you've ever made dashi at home, you know it starts with kombu, which is dried kelp, and you infuse it into water, kind of like a tea. And then you have this rehydrated kombu that you may not know what to do with. It's still delicious, and there's still a lot of nutrients in it. So what you can do is basically boil it down in a lot of soy sauce and a lot of sugar and mirin, and it becomes like a jammy kind of seaweed pickle. There it is. It's delicious. And it's so salty and so sweet that you only need a little spoonful of it to flavor a whole bowl of rice or a rice
it's
bowl.
It's kind of like licorice.
Yeah, it's very licorice-y. In fact, we just did an episode of The Kitchen Cabinet in Southend where I made cockle tsukudani out of local cockles. And the guy who there was a cockle farmer there, and he was like, tastes like cockle licorice, which doesn't sound very good.
No. It really doesn't.
But it's really, really good, and it's really economical because obviously if you're a fisherman, you sell all your prime catch to like the sushi chefs mainly, or to whoever's buying them, and then you're left with just like the dregs. You're left with the baby fish. You're left with the baby tiny crabs, the seaweeds, and then you learn what to do with them. And I think that's really cool and interesting that you make something so delicious from what would normally be discarded.
I want to talk quickly about cooking from this book, which we've thoroughly enjoyed, me and Sally, today.
Thank you.
We made a bento for you guys. I think what we find a lot of time intimidating with Japanese food is that you do have that kind of feeling that you need to kind of quit your job and dedicate your life to cooking rice.
Yeah.
Which is not, you know, really, it's not true. I think we cooked really nice rice. And you will be the judge. You will be the judge.
I will say about Japanese food is that it's very much like any other kind of food in that there is restaurant quality Japanese food.
Yeah.
And then there's home cooking. And you don't have to worry about it being perfect or beautiful or anything like that to make Japanese food at home. It just has to be delicious. And that's achievable. Making perfect rice for the perfect sushi, that's hard. But making good rice to have alongside some teriyaki chicken or something, that is very doable, very doable. If I can do it, so can you.
and of course, the ingredients are really easy to find.
Definitely, yeah.
We cooked the Japanese rice. We had our Japanese pastry chef had a beady eye watching over it. I think she was wanting us to fail a little bit.
Yeah.
And we made teriyaki chicken and egg, which is from the konbi section of the book.
From the sandwich.
It's meant to be a sandwich, but you got a bento instead. Because you're getting a sandwich for dessert, but we'll talk about this later. We made the cucumber and wakame salad, which is gorgeous. And lovely little pickles.
Oh, daikon pickles,
yeah.
Looks great. I really am impressed.
Yeah,
I genuinely am.
Well, you know, we always say if you enjoy it, it's our cooking, and if you don't, it's his recipes. But I think everyone's a winner from this. And for dessert, guys, we made Ichigo Sando.
Yes.
I'm pronouncing it correctly.
The Ichigo Sando, which is a strawberry sandwich, is exactly what it sounds like. It's strawberries and whipped cream put between two slices of sweet, cheap white bread. So it's like the poor man's Victoria sponge, basically. But it's great. They sell them at convenience stores. They sell them right alongside all the savory sandwiches. So when I first saw them, I was really confused. I was like, is it savory? But no, it's like it's a little... think of it as something you'd have with afternoon tea.
I want to thoroughly recommend for you this book. We both, me and Saeed, were just aching. You know, now I'm thinking, oh, we're going to wait the Olympics out, but...
I think we should all go together.
I think I
a Nanban Honey and Co. food tour.
Oh my god, that will be
Let's
the dream.
Pitch
we would eat so much.
Oh my god, oh my god, they're gonna close Japan after this. I want you guys to help me by giving a big hand to this guy.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening to our latest episode. If you'd like to join one of the next talks, please follow us on social media at Honey & Co. or go on our website, honeyandco.co.uk. With a huge thanks to Hester Kant for producing.
A special thanks to our own Louisa Cornford for her wonderful research.
And the music is by the lovely Alice Russell. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.